Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast whose vote is always available at a very reasonable price. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda, Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Actually, Steve, our legal department's got in touch. Apparently our vote is going to go for the best candidate in the election, regardless of payment.
What, you mean I'm not allowed to be treated?
Not really.
It would be a brilliant point to just go, and now a word from our sponsors.
If you do want to sponsor the podcast, though, we're always available for that, apart from Phil Willis. The reason we are talking about bribes is because bribes is the subject of this week's podcast. Over the past few weeks, there's been a couple of news stories where politicians have talked about bribes and have been criticised. In fact, Labour and the Tories have both been criticised from their own side for using bribes. So one example was Boris Johnson, when he started his campaign for the Tory leadership. His signature proposal was a tax cut for those earning between £50,000 and £80,000 a year, or, as they're known in the Tory party, low-income families, which Rory Stewart called a cheap bribe. And also footage of Margaret Hodge, who's a Labour MP, comments she made at Progress Conference talking about how Labour policy in 2017 was bribes. We are going to talk about, why is it that people vote? Do bribes work? Is offering freebies good politics? Is that what voters actually vote for? About bribes, we don't actually mean outright bribery, as in giving people 20 quid or a bottle of booze and getting them to vote. Although, incidentally, Steve, the academic evidence on whether bribes work is pretty mixed, actually. So there was, last year in India, there was a study into whether or not bribes actually affect, actually boost electoral outcomes. And apparently, in the southern state of Karnataka, apologies to our Indian listeners, authorities uncovered cash and other inducements like liquor worth more than £14.85 million, which was meant to be bribing voters.
That's a lot of liquor.
Really is, isn't it? Or one bottle of really nice liquor.
In which case, it's not a very effective bribery, because you can only bribe one person with that. No. There might be a flaw in the study.
You could do shots with it, maybe.
Oh, that would be good. It's like Goldschlager, but like with what? Platinum? And diamonds?
Diamondschlager. The worst James Bond film. What the academic found was essentially campaigns end up facing a sort of prisoner's dilemma, where essentially, let's say we were both running an election and we were both going to bribe people. If I thought that your campaign was going to bribe voters, I'd have to bribe voters too. And so essentially you have a bit of a zero-sum approach where each bribe cancels out everyone else's bribe.
Quite interesting, but it also demonstrates one little facet. It doesn't say that people didn't take the bribes. It just says everybody took the bribes and therefore voted along that bribe, along the way that their bribe was meant to, which suggests on a small level, actually it does work. It just doesn't have an overall impact, which is relevant, I think, for the next stages of the discussion.
Unless people took bribes from both campaigns and then voted however they wanted to.
Ah, that would be genius. We get Diamondschlager and a meal.
Diamondschlager squared. Actual outright bribery, in terms of not even just financial inducements, but just politicians giving out free stuff, is more a sign of anti-democratic or undemocratic regimes, say. So I'm rereading the Robert Harris novels on the life of Cicero. There's a populist politician called Clodius, who's essentially one of the first populist politicians. And his big thing is essentially giving everyone free grain. So it used to be that the Roman government would subsidise grain for the populace, and Clodius makes it free for everyone, which you'd be surprised to hear leads to quite bad financial problems for the Roman state. But also in the modern day, I suppose you've also got states like Saudi Arabia or Venezuela, which tend to be not very democratic and usually producing a particular, like who are oil rich, and so use the oil essentially to subsidise food prices and buy stuff for their population. We're not really talking about bribes in that sense either. And we're not going to talk about what they call pork barrel politics either. So pork barrel politics is essentially the idea that in a legislature, to try and get a bill through, you have to add different bits on to appeal to different groups. So you could say almost the government giving £1 billion in funding to Northern Ireland to please the DUP is an example of pork barrel politics. It's most common in American politics, isn't it?
Yeah, you'll quite often find situations where in order to get a bill through the House or Senate, the government of the day or whoever is trying to get the bill through are basically having to go and cut individual deals with individual senators or individual congressmen to get them to vote for the act. And fundamentally what that basically boils down to is they turn around and say the cost for me voting for this is you give us funding for this project. Because of the screwed up way that budgets are dealt with in the United States, they can do that basically ad infinitum.
Yeah, and so it can either act as wrecking amendments as well, can't it, to certain bills. But that's not really what we're going to be talking about either. We'll be instead, as I say, looking at those two examples, the Boris Johnson example, the Margaret Hodge example. So let's talk about the Boris Johnson example first. One of the first campaign pledges he made in his Daily Telegraph column when he was going to run for Prime Minister was this idea that we have tax cuts for people earning between £50,000 and £80,000 a year. And Rory Stewart attacks this as being a cheap bribe. And do you think that this would actually work, though? Do you think Tory members in the final two, bearing in mind, as we've said on other podcasts, Tory members tend to be richer than the general population at large, do you genuinely think Tory members are going to go, Boris Johnson's going to give me a tax cut and therefore more money, I'm going to vote for him?
No, I don't think that is actually how their kind of like thought process is working there. I think what they're seeing with a policy like that is an indication that actually Boris is going to look after them or their people or their demographic and that Boris is confirming that he's one of us. It's about Boris basically showing that he understands them and he understands their issues and he understands what motivates them, rather than it being a kind of a down and dirty, you vote for me for this and I'm going to put some money back in your back pocket.
I think you're right. The only problem I have is you've used Boris three times without specifically saying Boris Johnson or Mr. Johnson. Now, I'm not going to ask you for three predictions.
Oh, God.
And this is even harder because this is going to be released in the future. So we didn't really think about this.
Yes, for listeners who may have missed a few episodes, we've instigated a new rule on the podcast whereby if we refer to Boris Johnson just by his first name, we must make a prediction which will inevitably be wrong and be an embarrassment for whoever has to make it. So
I tell you, rather than give you three predictions, I'll ask you a question.
Go on.
So will Joe Biden still be top of opinion polling in the Democratic presidential race in 3 months' time?
Ooh, I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
That is probably going to be wrong, but I'll say yes because I can't think of anybody else really who's going to be able to overtake him at the moment. Maybe Warren or Sanders, but they're splitting each other's vote, in effect.
Going back to your point, I think you're right. I think the point with the tax cuts is it's more a signal of the kind of Conservative that he is and the kind of administration that he would govern. So we talked about buccaneering quite a lot in our episode on global Britain, but it's essentially Boris Johnson as this proto-Thatcherite, pro-business, ironically considering what he said about them, tax cutting, rewarding hard work and enterprise and success. It's more that angle really, and so it's more a symbol of the kind of Prime Minister he would be rather than just an outright bribe.
Yeah, I think it very much is much more in that kind of line of thinking. If for no other reason then, even if there is an element of, this will benefit me personally in somebody's like electoral calculations with policies like this, fundamentally people don't like to consider themselves to be that base. They like to think that they're voting in such a way as to you know, what's best for Britain, what's best for their friends, what's best for their family. I think you're more likely to find people justifying it of, that would really help my friends and that would really help my family, rather than this would really help them. And that's a slightly different take, even if it still boils down to it helps them because it's cash in their pocket.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know if it's more charitable or more cynical to say, but people will find a reason to believe in voting for Boris Johnson rather than just they're going to get more money. And as you say, you can spin it as, well, he seems to want to look after my friends and people like me, or it's that politics that I'm into, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that cuts both ways across all elements of the political spectrum. That's broadly speaking how people vote and make their electoral decisions. Very rarely is it about individual policies. It's much more about, as you say, the kind of like the kind of actually utilising this word in its proper sense, the virtue signalling that you actually can, you're projecting on through your act of voting. You are saying, this is who I am by your support of this party or this person.
I would tend to agree with that. And when you look at the various theories of democracy that political scientists have, and we're not going to list all of them, partly because I haven't read the books and partly because...
I would kill you.
And partly that, and partly this is only meant to be a nice, snappy 30-minute podcast. But what the theories of democracy generally say is that people generally don't vote on policy. You know, Tony Benn's argument that somehow it's not policies that matter, it's not personalities that matter, but policies, isn't quite right. I mean, Tony Benn's career is probably actually quite a good example of that.
Yeah, I mean, and there's lots of examples of this as well. So, like, if you take a kind of an example of the Lib Dems, actually, if you quiz people on Lib Dem policies, they really like, at least historically, Lib Dem policies. Didn't lead to the Lib Dems necessarily gaining that much ground politically. There's lots of reasons for that. First past the post electoral system being chief among them. But people don't necessarily just didn't identify as Lib Dems, even if they liked the policies in the same way that people identified as Labour or as Tory. And that inhibited their ability to actually grow their core vote.
Although I can think of one Lib Dem policy that was famous that did attract people to vote for the party, that then didn't end so well.
Yeah.
Sorry for reminding you, Mark, and hello, by the way. I suppose, so there's that, isn't there, that you can have popular policies, but that doesn't mean that people will vote for you. The flip side of that is, often people will vote for something, or vote for a party that is directly at odds with their financial interests. So, good example, I think I spoke on this, talked about this on the podcast before, when we talked about the idea of a culture war a year or two ago. This is Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And Thomas Frank wanted to find out why Kansas, I believe it's his home state, why were people in Kansas, quite a poor state, why were they voting for Republican candidates who weren't concerned with their financial self-interest? You know, if they were interested in their finances and improving their own wealth situation, they would vote Democrat, not Republican. What Thomas Frank found when he did research for the book is that there are lots of social and cultural touchstones that people found more important than simply income itself. And obviously in America, that tended to be abortion. It tended to be gun control as well. Yeah, lots of other social cultural issues like that, rather than mere income.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily that surprising when you think about it. I mean, there are very few people that I know which put in, and I say this as somebody who's surrounded by an awful lot of people who are actually really into politics. There are very few people I know that kind of sit down every election and weigh up the policy manifestos of all the parties and come to a decision in that regards. Actually, what they tend to do is they just kind of go, they have a notion of whether they're left wing or right wing and what kind of parties they roughly associate with. And unless something changes drastically, they'll just lurch to the one that they most identify with.
Well, indeed, I mean, people tend to vote either based on how they voted in the past or based on their social cultural values, like that virtue signaling that we've talked about, or maybe just they've almost always voted that way. I mean, looking at the European elections, that's why people voted for Labour, the Conservatives. The main reason given for both was they'd always voted for that party. Now, that is the idea that I voted Labour or Tory because my parents did and my grandparents did. It's breaking down slightly now, but it's still a big thing. You know, people being told, well, we vote Labour because that's what people like us do, or we vote Tory because that's what people like us do. And there isn't necessarily a lot of thought going into that. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's why people buy the same newspaper, or I always have Radio 4 on in the morning. It's just habit, isn't it?
People in life essentially just gravitate towards certain options because, you know, it's easier to just kind of get through the day if you don't necessarily kind of weigh up the options every time. There's a reason you buy the same cereal every time you go to shopping. It's because you know you like it. Even though maybe you know you should eat something a bit healthier and get some all bran rather than buying, you know, Frosted Flakes or whatever. People just get into that habit of it, as you say. And as a result, it just becomes a formulaic part of their behaviour and their actions. And unless something drastically happens to make you shift your perspective on something, you're not going to change your behaviour, at least not without an awful lot of effort.
This could well be a dated joke, but I do feel in the Tory leadership election, Boris Johnson is definitely the Frosted Flakes, if not even actually Lucky Charms, and Rory Stewart is definitely the all brown in the corner.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Rory Stewart is definitely high in fibre.
Matt Hancock, I reckon, is muesli.
See, I was going to go with Sage Javid as muesli.
No, I think Matt Hancock is more exotic, so Matt Hancock's definitely muesli. Jeremy Hunt is Weetabix.
That somehow is the perfect description of Jeremy Hunt, without mispronouncing his surname,
which we haven't done.
No,
amazingly,
it's almost like it's not actually that difficult to do.
Not now he's not culture secretary. For me, and again, this could well be dated in a couple of weeks' time because who knows what he's going to say in the next 2 weeks. But as at the moment, Sajid Javid has been a lot better than I assumed he would be. So maybe Sajid Javid is a bit like. Like shredded wheat with apricots in it or something. We think, do I really need? I don't know if that works. If
that's yeah, it. I get what you mean with it. It's a relatively bland situation, but there's a little bit of something there, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think we spent far too long debating what breakfast cereals the Tory leadership contenders are.
I know, it's another podcast idea down the pan, isn't it? Because I spent half an hour on that.
The sad thing is we probably could have.
We probably could. What cereal is Jeremy Corbyn?
Let's not go down that road. He's obviously oatmeal.
The thing is, I suppose voting in terms of financial self-interest goes the other way as well. You end up with this situation where those people, the working class Tories or blue-collar Republicans, you know, Marxists would call it false consciousness, which always seems a bit off because it seems a bit patronising to assume you want to be down, you know, have to vote for your financial self-interest and might have other things you care about too. Because the flip side of that obviously is those metropolitan elitists they have now, those people who are wealthier, generally more liberal left, you know, you're not going to have, let's say you've got, where we are, you know, in Bournville, we're near to Bournville, very affluent area, you're going to have a lot of big Lib Dem vote, big Green vote, big Labour vote. Well, they're not going to start voting Tory just because Boris Johnson promises them a big tax cut.
No, absolutely not. And essentially, it just boils down to the fact that money, especially, isn't necessarily that much of a motivator for people's decision-making in a lot of ways. Now, obviously, in politics, you can present money being spent in different ways. You could talk about that bribe, quote unquote, in terms of, you know, educational programs maybe, or you know, money for veterans, whatever you want to kind of present it up as. But the actual kind of core notion of this money goes into my back pocket as a result of this policy isn't going to influence people that much. And you can actually see this in an awful lot of different areas of life. You know, psychologists have actually researched this properly, and they know that when it comes to decisions in terms of moving jobs or changing careers and things like that, actually, money is only a negative kind of like modifier of your likelihood and your motivation. If you're comfortable, you don't necessarily, you can't be motivated to do more by the promise of more money. You can only be, you only just end up in, you only kind of get negatively motivated, or your motivation takes a hit when you just feel like you're not being paid enough for whatever reason. But if you're comfortable and happy, money doesn't affect your day-to-day life decision-making in that sense. So it would make sense that would also apply to, at least in an explicit way, to policy decisions that people make.
Yeah, and maybe just a slight end point to this, because I realise we've gone 20 minutes and I haven't talked about Brexit.
Oh, that's weird.
Well, so only that, there was a Dan Hanan column I read in the Telegraph at my in-laws, because now the Telegraph is premium. I don't need to pay for that sort of stuff. I've got enough things that make me cry without wanting to subscribe to the Telegraph online. But there was a Dan Hanan column that was taking issue with the argument of those of us in favour of another EU referendum, because a lot of the things, certainly on the Labour side, what a lot of people will say is that nobody voted to be poorer. And Dan Hanan took issue with this, and he says, well, actually, that's not true. People vote to be poorer all the time, and talks about the kind of things we've talked about. Mentions, I think, specifically things like subsidies for the arts, where people will support something which is culturally enriching rather than anything which maybe personally benefits you. That, I think, is slightly different, because obviously the thing with Brexit is that people were promised they would be richer. People were promised that things would be better, even if, again, people voted for Brexit not necessarily to get richer, but because of a touchstone of identity, cultural reasons. And even now, if they're given evidence that people will be poorer, a lot of people say, well, it's worth it. It feels like a slightly different argument to make. Now, that is, the problem is that the reality of Brexit is at odds with the promises that were made 3 years ago.
Yeah, tend to agree. I'm not really sure there's much more to add on that, other than that Brexit is, in many ways, probably a classic indicator of that kind of that culture divide. I mean, it's certainly turned into that, whether or not it was that to begin with. But it certainly is now that kind of indicative of a cultural divide in British society. People are choosing sides and are making policy decisions just based on that axis, either leave or are you remain. The actual kind of financial implications and the notion of bribery in any concept isn't going to really come into it.
Maybe let's think about another reason why parties and politicians offer big eye-catching policies like tax cuts or free tuition fees, that sort of thing. And that's essentially to keep and preserve a voting coalition. Now, a good example of this, actually, I think, is the issue of ending free TV licences for the over 75s. And the BBC ended that a few weeks ago, and there was a little bit of an outcry and a bit of a kerfuffle. Again, shared by my non-political friends on Facebook, so you know when they're sharing things about that, it's an issue that's kind of cut down. More so, indeed, than the issue of what serial Matt Hancock is, which doesn't really seem to get much traction at the moment among my non-political friends.
I mean, who can blame them?
But the free TV licences is an interesting one, because part of the Cameron Osborne electoral shtick for the Tories was they wanted to keep their voting coalition together, and older voters is a group that not only votes in disproportionately high numbers, but generally voted Conservative in a disproportionately high numbers, and so needed little freebies needed incentives for them to come out voting. And that's one of the reasons why you have policies like free TV licences. Now, what's happened this time, actually, is Theresa May's government have chosen another play from the Cameron Osborne playbook, which is they took the money away from the BBC, gave the BBC the responsibility of finding money for free TV licences. Lo and behold, the BBC doesn't have that money, and essentially have had to do the cuts themselves, and are now being blamed for implementing those cuts, in just the same way that the coalition government essentially front-loaded a load of cuts onto local councils for things like social care. And lo and behold, there is a social care crisis. But it's local councils, and Birmingham City Council's being blamed for a lot of things which essentially it can't deliver the services it needs to, because it doesn't have any money, because the government's taken away the money from it. But it's not the government that's being blamed necessarily, it's the council that gets in the neck first and foremost.
Yeah, it's a classic kind of almost bait and switch from central politics down to the local level. And the TV licence issue with the BBC is kind of like another example of that, as you say. I mean, the interesting thing with this is that it does seem to be cutting through as an issue. But again, just to kind of take this back to the notion of kind of like bribery and people acting in their own financial interests and all of that, the people who are sharing this online, partially because these are people who actually are online, aren't the ones who are being hit by this at all. The people I've seen sharing it are well under that 75-year-old benchmark level, and yet they're still apoplectic about that this has been brought in, to the extent that I've seen some people share some factually incorrect memes, I'm just going to say.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Memes on Facebook that I don't understand.
I know. Which are saying that people who are over 75 are the people who fought on D-Day's beaches and all of that, and we deserve, they should be treated like... treated well as a result, and therefore they need to keep their free license fee, ignoring the fact that you need to be like 90 odd really to have been participated in D-Day. I digress. It's a very big kind of issue which is cutting through, but it does demonstrate that people aren't getting worked up about it because of its impact on them, it's on the people around them, and the perceived impact on people that they care about or that are culturally well respected. I.e. the elderly.
Speaking of the elderly, even if not necessarily universally respected, let's talk about what Margaret Hodge said. Does that work as a segue?
That works. We'll keep stick it. With it.
Essentially, she was recorded saying, I want a Labour Party that brings honesty to the table. At the moment, we've got a whole range of unrealistic promises. And she mentioned specifically, we're going to reverse all the cuts, mentions tuition fees, and talked about this as promises that won't be fulfilled. And she says that these sorts of bribes are not the way to win an election. That's what she says. Now, this seemed to get a little bit of traction on the Labour left, pro-Corbyn sort of news sites. So I've seen this on Evolve Politics, I've seen this on The Canary, who I think got quite annoyed at it. I think partly because it was a comment made at Progress Conference, and people who attend Progress Conference, as we know, all have seven heads and make a ritual sacrifice of John McDonnell before they start speaking. How justified do you think their outrage is?
I mean, not massively. I don't think Hodge did herself any favours with how she worded this.
No.
But I don't think she's necessarily wrong with her core point here. I mean, I think what she's basically saying is we're promising all of these things that we're going to do at once, when the reality is we need to prioritise, because you can't deliver necessarily all of these things in one go. And that's not a slight at anybody's skills or anybody's political abilities or anything like that. It's just a cold, hard fact that you only have so much bandwidth to get things through. And when you are looking at some quite radical changes as well, an awful lot of bandwidth is going to be taken up at any one point by one or two issues, which means the other issues are going to end up naturally on the back burner anyway. And that's before you get into the potential financial implications of some of them. Like, if you are going to nationalise the railways, what's the cost to that? You know, that sort of thing. So I don't necessarily think she's wrong. I just think she's kind of worded that very, very badly, and not in any way that's actually helpful for debate, because it's immediately just being able to be positioned as polarising.
No, I mean, it makes her sound like she's pro-austerity.
Yeah.
Which I would imagine she probably isn't. Well, I think the point she's making, as you say, it's partly about prioritising. And this is where, as a bit of an aside, I think that actually Labour could do with taking a bit of a leaf out of Margaret Thatcher's book, because anyone who's read Charles Moore's huge biographies of Margaret Thatcher will tell you she's actually a much cannier politician than maybe one the stereotype would recognise, but also one that had a ruthless plan and carried it out. I mean, you can see that with the different trade unions the order in which she took on the trade unions, ending with the miners, for instance. And so prioritising, definitely. I think also, I'd have thought the point that Margaret Hodge maybe could have made but didn't is more the credibility aspect, like how are you going to pay for this? I mean, memories of 1992 and the tax bombshell and all that kind of thing. And that seems to be, if you're going to make that argument, a better way of doing it. Like, okay, you want to reverse the cuts, how are you going to pay for it? Now, admittedly, there were costings in Labour's last manifesto, so there are plans there, but that feels like a better avenue if you're going to question it.
Yeah, I don't think Margaret Hodge did herself or anybody else any favours with the way she talked about this issue. We're assuming that she has effectively good intentions behind this, and, you know, it may be that actually she doesn't. And if she doesn't have good intentions and she's actually sat there kind of going, no, we can't end austerity, well then screw you, Margaret Hodge. But I don't necessarily think that is the case.
No, I think she comes from a position of wanting Labour to get a general election. I mean, I think this gets lost a lot in Labour at the moment, especially over the Brexit stuff, is whether or not you support our policy on, like, I think the issue of, do we support Remain or another referendum, or how much do we want to nationalise, or how quickly will it take us to reverse the cuts? I think partly it is that everyone wants to see Labour government, everyone wants to see these things. It's more a question of priorities and a question of temperament and a question of, I think Margaret Hodges, a politician from that kind of background, like, as we've said, like, New Labour was very cautious, and Margaret Hodges from that background, where ideally you want to be able to deliver things that you can promise. And I think it's not necessarily that those promises, or bribes as she called them, but those promises won't win an election. Almost the problem is the payback, the blowback from that turns out actually either we can't do those things, or we do them but don't have money and then end up in financial problems. But I also think what Margaret Hodges is doing is making a little bit of a mistake, like, as we've, or a false assumption, I should say. As we've said, people don't necessarily vote for parties based on their policies. It tends to be about a lot of the virtue signalling, that kind of thing. So if we think about Labour's 2017 manifesto, we talked about it at the time, and given the fact it was leaked, there was a bit of a fuss and hysteria about it. It's seen by a lot on the Labour left as this totemic expression of all the good of social democracy, and it's the thing that helped Labour do get 40% of the vote in 2017. And especially, Margaret Hodge mentions tuition fees. Well, the fact that a lot of young people came out and voted for Labour, Labour's position on tuition fees was seen as being part of that. Whereas actually, maybe looking back, we can see, well, maybe actually Brexit was a more important issue. Again, another 15 minutes has gone by, got to talk about Brexit. In terms of that virtue signalling, in terms of thinking about Leave and Remain identities, like you've mentioned, a lot of people of a Remain-minded bent voted Labour in 2017 because they thought it was going to stop Brexit. And again, I would argue, if you have a student who votes in a snap election in 6 months' time, are they going to think, ooh, Labour's got free tuition fees? Or are they going to think, well, I want to vote for a party that's going to stop Brexit? We'll be back next week. In the meantime, we have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. Dave Depper's responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. And James Cram designed our logo. My Twitter handle is @paperbackwriter.
Mine's @acousticradical.
Happy plotting.